Hey guys, Jim Cox, and I'm here today with an interview with Jeff Bragg. He is the founder of Superfood Consulting, and we had connected on LinkedIn. I had noticed some of his comments regarding sustainable food practices and reached out, wanted to learn more. So Jeff, thanks for taking the time to chat today.
You're welcome. James,
so tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get involved in terms of looking at food and sustainability and what that means?
Well, you know, James, I wish I could, my video was working. The hat that I have on takes me back to my grandfather. It's a open road Stetson from the 1950s. Mm-hmm. I was raised on a regenerative organic farm in a town called Jerome, Idaho, in southern Idaho. And this is where my grandparents came in the early 1900s, and Matt and great-grandfather, grandpa, and my mom and dad. And I was lucky enough to live in the most glorious neighborhood rural life than you can imagine out in Idaho. We had, we raised sheep, beef cattle, a few dairy to go to the cooperative. We had 14 or 15 different crops. My father and grandfather were very active in agriculture, but it was regenerative and organic back until the early 1960s. And I guess when you ask me about food, that's probably the thing that has got me going right now to bring my whole history of my agriculture life together. Is I was born in 1958, and in 1963, as you know, you're getting weaned off of bottles and starting to eat food. Every time I ate something, I would end up with hives and asthma. And there was nobody that understood what was going on around agriculture. So that was my first relationship with food, was actually my first bite of sweet corn being raced to the hospital because I couldn't breathe and had hives. And probably the second, and then I was allergic to all berries, and then I was allergic to all grass. And it was interesting, I was allergic to all foods and allergic to all trees except for pine trees. And I was allergic to all nuts except for pine nuts. And so when I was 5 years old, I started on this to where we had to drive on two-lane roads from the middle of southern Idaho down to Reno, Nevada, and to go to a specialist because there really wasn't any at that time. And then that worked for a little while. I started taking shots at 5 years old until I got out of high school, two to three times a week. And then I don't know what they gave me or anything else, but I watched that part of my life on the food side. And that started me out. And then once I got into where I could actually go out in the fields, after all these immunization shots or whatever they gave me, then I became my dad's shovel expert. And I watched our southern Idaho go from the canal system that had started the mighty potato industry in Idaho. And I watched it go from furrow irrigation to every kind of sprinkler and now to all center pivot, and the whole area's gone. The rotations are gone. Our neighborhood's gone. It's turned into it's gone from a rotational regenerative thing where all of our neighbors lived with each other and helped each other to a handful of people. And I wasn't going to be in farming. After shoveling ditch and things, and so I was actually going to go into landscape horticulture or something. And when I got married to my wife in 1979, my dad, he told me, as he filled out my marriage license and I needed a job. And he says, I'll tell you what, he says, I think you're really good with soil. I want to introduce you to my agronomist and my soil testing lab. And so in 1980, I actually started working for them right after I got married, and worked for one of the first consulting labs in the United States, for a soil scientist. Hmm. And that's where I met all kinds of people that would shape my life to where it is today. And I'm really fortunate, James, that I had really great mentors. And this is pre chemical agriculture mentors, people that had new things before the Green Revolution took over.
The quote unquote Green Revolution.
The quote unquote Green Revolution. And the problem that I have now is I'm actually back. Because of that food allergies, I'm back actually getting tested for some of the things that poisoned me when I started chemical agriculture as an agronomist. I was one of four or five people that actually worked for the first genetically modified company way before it was ever Monsanto.
Wow.
And there was four or five of us that worked for this group, and they were called Plant Genetics out of California. And then they became Calgene, and then they went to the Kieran Brewing Company. And then it ended up in Monsanto. And then the potato part of it came back to Idaho. And now that part of it is back in Idaho.
Hmm.
And so, then on top of that, then my soil scientist, there was two labs. I was different. My soil scientist mentor wanted me to be able to feel the soil and to feel the moisture and to feel the sand and the silt and the clay and understand the composition of soil. And so he wouldn't let us put meters out in these fields of potatoes. He would make us take soil samples next to the plant. And then I was also taking leaf samples.
Hmm.
And 40 years ago this year, I got poisoned by a compound called forate or thymate. And it was widely used in potatoes. It what's interesting is I look back on it now, and I'm my real learnings really came in the last 7 or 8 years. But you know, you get lockstep into this fear-based agriculture of the Green Revolution. And then so I'm working with this product, and it's called Thymet 4-8. It got into my blood system, and through the soil sampling, when you go out and take samples with moisture in it, and that they would put this compound in the potato planters an inch above the seed as they planted it in these boxes, and it smells awful. But the thing that happened to it is we were taking these plant samples and these soil samples, and then it got into my, you know, your hands are green from the chlorophyll, and it takes the stuff goes up the potato plant, up into the leaves, kills any bugs on top of it that eats on it, and then it translocates back down to the tubers. And so there was like a 90-day window that you couldn't eat them because it was inside the potatoes.
Hmm.
Well, I was touching it with my hands and stuff, and I got it in my fingers, and I was getting headaches. And then my hired man that was out helped me take soil samples, he goes over to the planter, and he takes his hand, he looks over there, and he sees the stuff that fell on the ground because they didn't tell anybody about that 16th of a teaspoon would kill you. And he came out of a wet field, stepped on this black smelly compound, and got it on his shoes, and then got it in the carpeting of our pickup to where every morning we could smell it. And then you're getting it in dermally and inhaling it too. And then you look over at the planter, and here's these Mexican workers
yeah.
that you know, come up And we didn't have, by the way, James, we didn't have Mexican workers until probably the early 1970s on our farm. And that's when the whole immigration, because of big ag, really took off. But here's these workers using brown jersey gloves to smooth off the top of these applicators with this dry compound. Huh. And so when here I'm sick, got headaches, I get then told I got an organophosphate poisoning at that point. And but I'm still in lockstep agriculture. So I go to the state of Idaho and I get on the worker safety. I get on it to where we implement worker safety laws for people.
Uh-huh.
And that was one of my first things I did after I got poisoned.
So how long, when did you leave the chemical company, the soil company?
Well, I didn't, the soil company, I still to this day send soil samples to them because they still do the samples the way they were taught 40, 50 years ago. So I still send my samples to them, but I went from there back to the family farm and then got into the production of back in our family farm in the late 80s and 90s. And then I went through the NAFTA times mm-hmm. with agriculture and the consolidation of agriculture. And I people have no idea how much consolidation has happened and no idea.
Yeah,
there are 46 family potato grower families in our county in 1996. Now to the day, there is two families, they're corporate farms. They are, one of them was one of the people from a long time ago, but the others are all out of business.
Is it the same acreage growing potatoes or has that shrank?
It's increased.
So you have fewer actors owning more acreage to do more production, but it's under a more restrictive mode.
Very much more restricted. Hmm. It's gone from 1,200 and some growers, and they actually list it at like 300 and some growers, but 600 or 700 of us went out of business from 1996 to 2000. But when you talk to the big potato boards, they say it really didn't have an effect. Mm. And then, I ended up leaving Idaho and back to those roots of those people that started the first GM. I got that they wanted to know if I was interested in going to California to learn about red, white, and yellow potatoes and things. And that's where I ended up. In 2000, I left my wife and three daughters out on the desert in Idaho. And I moved to California and started working in California with red, white, and yellow potatoes and asparagus in 2000. And that, but it just was kind of a strange thing that happened to my wife and my kids and I. There was actually so many farmers went out of business. They had an alternative career program at Idaho. Mm. And so after 2 years in California, I went back to the University of Idaho where I had met my wife in a dance class. And I went back and started back in school and got my daughters back and we all went back to school. And I actually was working on one of my projects was called Reinventing the Potato. And I've worked on the first intellectual property rights of potatoes that were coming out at that time. And people were starting to learn about intellectual property rights and owning varieties. So I did the first work on potatoes on ownership of varieties.
Hmm. So what is Superfood Consulting and how does that get into dealing with your health issues that you had mentioned?
Superfood Consulting, when I ended up working for a very large food company as their vice president of product development. I also started their breeding and seed program as well. And it was such that I just I don't know why I'm on this journey to understand this, but on the food side, it was looking at these different kinds of components of varieties. There's only one nutritional label for all potatoes in the United States. And no matter where they're grown, no matter if they're purple, yellow, and by the way, we're only supposed to have white flesh potatoes in the United States. All of the French fries and baked potatoes and everything are, it's all based on the white flesh potato.
Well, doesn't the soil content though actually determine the nutritional value of the plant?
Every soil has a different nutritional backdrop for each, and every variety has a different component. And the reason it's called superfood consulting is because potatoes are the food that actually probably changed the world. It's
In
the
what
food.
Way?
Well, number one, it's one of the only things that you can survive on. We would not be the melting pot in the United States if it wasn't for the Irish potato famine. It was the food that almost every person coming across from the East Coast to the West Coast survived on, just like the Irish. And potato actually is one of the only things that you can eat if you have one food to choose from that you can eat to actually live off of. It has water, fiber, vitamin C is higher than oranges, potassium. And the thing about it is they're all radically different, but it's the chemicals and the way they're handled in these massive farms when there's less managers of storages and everything else that are creating the problems for diabetics and things, why they get such a bad rap. And I was asked to give a talk on the glycemic index in Holland in 2000 and in 2011. And I'd had problems with my own self. I was always active as a farmer, but as a product developer vice president, I wasn't as active. And I didn't think anything of it, except for it had diverticulitis that summer. And I went to the gastroenterologist 2 weeks before I gave the presentation in the Netherlands on the glycemic index. And I said, "Hey doc, I need some information on the glycemic index, cause I'm giving this presentation." And he says, I'll tell you what, I'm going to do you something, a favor. I'm going to send you over to the diabetes center for testing. And when you get over there," he says, "you ask them about the glycemic index and get some of your facts and figures for your PowerPoint." So I did. I went and one of the slides in my presentation was actually them taking blood out of my arm and me not knowing the results of my readings. I came back from the Netherlands, got back into Idaho, and got a phone call from the doctor, and they wanted to visit with me, my family doctor and the gastroenterologist. And I was insulin resistant and type 2 diabetic.
And you didn't know it.
And I should have known it, you know, but I never put weight and obesity in that thought process. I'm 5'7" and I weighed at that time 240 pound with a 18 and a half inch neck and a 40 inch waist, and I'm 5'7". And so they told me to start just doing a strict carbohydrate, cut your carbohydrates down on things. And that's what led me into organics. Within 1 year, I'd lost 80 pounds. The hat that I have on and things are my grandfather's. I now can wear all of my dad's shirts and everything else. Went on metformin and changed my diet. Within 4 years, was off all of the, I've been off all of the diabetes drugs now since 2015.
So there's like probably 20 gopher holes in all the things that we talked about, rabbit holes to go down.
Yep.
From all the things that you talked about. So What, you mentioned when we first started talking that they switched from regenerative practices, rotational crops, to the circle irrigation mode.
Yep.
What does that do to the soil quality and to the crop itself, whether it's potatoes or whatever?
Well, what it does, it's an implement. The way I see it now, it's phenomenal how they work, and the computers can tell from space that, and then they're going on and the application rates and everything else. What it does, they're circular. So all of the corners between the circles are where, to make it easy so you don't have main lines and infrastructure out to the corners, most states don't water the corners. And so they become the place where you just take the Roundup in and spray the corners between the pivots. And that's how, and then that's where your resistant tumbleweeds start. And I can almost take you to every single location in the United States where there's a batch of pivots and show you exactly where the resistance starts from glyphosate.
Hmm. What do you mean resistant? Like there, the other crops being resistant to the, to encourage, you know, crop disease?
It's been so widely used that Mother Nature's already overcome glyphosate. Mm. So there's resistant weeds. You look down these fields now, they have to add other compounds to the glyphosate to make it effective to try to kill the things, like in a cornfield. Mm. And so it takes, now you see weeds that are growing, but they overcome some of it by over application of fertility too. And then they've made all these liquid based fertilizers, you know, the dry fertilizers were one thing. Then a host of liquid fertilizers came in. Mm. And so you've got these liquid fertilizers, and they've got it down to where they've got people thinking they've got to put all these things on. What got me was when I switched to organic after I'd been in lockstep. I switched to organic production. The reason I switched to organics is, I'll tell you how I got into organics, was reading those carbohydrate levels back on ketchup. You know, I was looking at ketchup, reading these labels for the amount of carbs that they told me I could eat and ingest. When I find that there was twice as much sugar in conventional ketchup due to the high fructose corn syrup, mm-hmm. than there was in organics. And that's what got me looking into organics. And then I saw that the price of organic production of potatoes and for special types, I thought I could make a living doing it. Mm-hmm. And so I left the company I was with, and I resigned as their, and sold my shares. I was one of the shareholders, and I sold my stock, and I went after organic production because they didn't want to do organics.
So were you able to make a living doing organic production?
Well, what I found was interestingly enough, there's this thing called photosynthesis that works. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, the first years of my crops, I used nothing. And that put me kind of in a bad position though, because here I've brought three or four compounds and helped introduce them into the mainstream of big ag. One of them is a biofumigant, which biofumigant means kills everything, and you inject it through the pivots. And I did the first application of that material in the United States. It's now used globally. It's used so much to kill everything in the soil so these people can go and put potatoes in it, that has killed all the life in the soil too. So now they're figuring out they got to add biology back to the soil to correct it. But what I found, James, was that when there's some diseases and things that I was trying to get rid of by massive fungicide programs and stuff, because appearance sells in potatoes. Mm-hmm. And things. And what I was finding, the only way I can get rid of these diseases now is by being organic. I have one of them is an insect virus that's worldwide that everybody's worrying that it's called PVY. I have yet to have a reading of it.
Hmm. So, so the soil that you used on your farm in Idaho, which was, I assume you went back to your family farm. Is that what you ended up doing?
No, I went back. I went back to my family farm, but NAFTA took us out in the 90s.
Gotcha.
And so when I left there, I had such a sphere of influence, though, in the potato side of things that I went to some places that I knew was upstream of all of the chemicals. Uh-huh. And all of the aphids and everything else, and started to plant potatoes in a place north of Boise, Idaho.
So that ground had all the nutrients that had been in other places killed off by the fungicide and kind of bleached the soil. So you were able to avoid that.
Yeah, they had raised potatoes years in the past as seed, but because of conglomeration, all the seed areas went to one part of the state, and this part was left. And so I went and I started raising potatoes there. But the problem is people start seeing that you can grow stuff without anything. Mm-hmm. That really gets scary, especially when you've been as involved as I have. Scary
for your safety, or scary?
Well, it's scary for my safety now, because I've proved that it works in multiple states. I've grown potatoes all over. I'm a global potato expert. Since all these things have happened, I've ended up working clear into Siberia. But yeah, it's pretty scary if you tell people they don't need fertilizers and chemicals anymore, and that you don't have the diseases.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example that maybe you can, and you might have. Do you ever see go in and get red potatoes in grocery stores?
Yeah, they're my favorite.
You ever notice that they have that they're gray sometimes?
I haven't seen that.
Well, you ought to go down and take a good look at these red potatoes. If you see that they're kind of off color and they're not bright red, and right now, right as they come out of the field, they're going to be bright red.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just go down and look real close, and you'll find that some silvery looking red potatoes.
Mm.
That is from a compound that has got resistance in the potatoes themselves, and it harbors itself in storages and things. And it's kind of an interesting, I'm talking pretty frank here. If you put COVID and pesticides in a search engine, you will come up with the name of this compound. That compound I was putting on crops throughout Canada and the U.S. as a program, and I could not get rid of it because color sells.
Uh-huh.
But these gray red potatoes are almost 100% the cause from these resistant fungicides.
Huh.
So we not only have resistant herbicides, we have resistant fungicides.
So when you have a company that is making these types of chemicals to put on food in massive quantities, I mean, to the casual observer, you would think that there's some sort of safety test program on what it does to human health. But, you know, from what I've heard before, there's none of that, or at the very best, it's not even worth noting.
It's not worth it. So, you know what you do? The way I ended up with all these, the first they give you a ball cap, and then they take you to the meetings. You know, they've flown me all over to meetings, to Key West, to various places. That's how they get farmers together. It's so simple. And then the FDA, I think it's as simple as taking somebody out to dinner. I'm telling you that there's no safety controls from what I see.
Yeah. Yeah. So you had mentioned that you were able to get the intellectual property for different breeds or varieties of potatoes, like purple potatoes or what have you. Like, so what's the nature of, and I've seen, like, especially I think it's in Peru, they have a lot of different varieties of potatoes.
Thousands.
Yeah. And so what are the, are there differences in terms of the health benefits of different types of potatoes that you see out there? Because I mean, normally we only see those, you know, russet or the red potatoes. So, I mean, to find even something else, like, A, where would you find another variety of potato if you were a consumer? But are there differences in terms of what those other potatoes do for a person's health or for their, you know?
Oh, absolutely. What I found was I've introduced a lot of the baby potatoes and a lot of the, like, purple potatoes and things like that that are in there. And so, and what I found also now is that now that I've taken the insecticides out of potatoes, all of a sudden these potatoes flower and they actually blossom. And the pollinators will actually go in them and they'll create a berry on top of where the flower is. When you take that berry and you open it up, you get true potato seeds, and they call it TPS. And this, by the way, they're looking at this as another way of feeding the world, because right now, the only if you take those seeds out of those little berries and you put them in a blender and you take the seeds out and you plant each one of the seeds, each one of them is different than the parent tuber.
That's wild.
Yeah. Well, we were taught by the fertilizer companies you didn't want them to flower. And so now I realize why that is. I took my first potato science class 40 years ago this year. And I asked the professor this because the fertilizer company told me that you don't want them flowering. It's a sign of stress. And I asked the potato professor.
Sign of stress.
And so I asked the professor that exact, just like you just laughed. I asked the professor that. I said, I've been told that we don't want them to flower because it's a sign of stress. And he was a Japanese fellow, and his name was Dr. Willie Iritani, and he was world famous for certain things that he found out about potatoes. And he says, potatoes will flower if the wind blows too much. Potatoes will flower if it's too hot. They'll flower if it's too cold. They'll flower if they don't have enough nitrogen. They'll flower if they have too much. They'll flower. And he's just like your reaction. He says, they're going to flower. The only way you can keep them from flowering is by over-nitrification, and you keep them in a vegetative state. But now I've got flowers, and the pollinators come in. I even see hummingbirds now in potato flowers. But back to my, there was one thing you asked about fear base. I was trained to kill every bug in every potato field if I found one aphid, because of this. One aphid was, so the first year I did it organically, we had 25 varieties growing. I saw an aphid and I didn't spray it. And I also helped set up what's called the winter test, where you go to, like, Hawaii, to a place in the winter, and you take your seed from places like Idaho or wherever, and you grow them before you plant them again, and they grow them, and then they take leaf samples. And they tell you whether you have virus or not. I was so scared going to Hawaii to look at, because I hadn't killed that one aphid and I had all these potatoes growing, seed potatoes. I was a wreck. I had sweat rings down to my waist because I was so nervous that I was going to go over there and they were going to be rejected because of virus levels. And I never had anything. And I never had anything since. Crazy.
Well, I mean, one of the things, I guess, is, you know, in terms of the web of life, if there's aphids, it's going to attract things that eat aphids, and that keeps the crop, you know, clean, so to speak. So, but if you don't have that food source for the predators of the aphids, you're not going to have that. So it's a cascade, right?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of wild is that I use ladybugs now. That's what I do. You buy ladybugs and I put ladybugs out. That's how I spray my fields.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is, though, is the larva of a ladybug looks remarkably like the larva of the Colorado potato beetle that was the mask of that compound that I got poisoned by.
Hmm.
That's what they were using it for. And now I realize when I look at the larvae, we were being trained to call it something else rather than what it was.
Hmm.
So we could kill it.
Yeah. Yeah. We're getting up to the end of our time here. And I really think we're going to have to do another show to kind of dig down farther into this. If people want to learn more about the work that you do, Jeff, how can they reach out to you?
The best way to reach out to me, my preferred way, is through superfoodconsulting@icloud.com. Because I want them to see superfood. And the reason I say consulting is I help everybody. Mm-hmm. We're on a health-driven mission. And I'll end it with this, with James. When you store potatoes too cold and you see the russets in the store, they get taken down to 38 degrees to store them,
mm-hmm.
to hold them so they don't sprout. That mm-hmm. creates a 300 to 400% increase in sugar.
Really?
Yes. The change from 45 degrees to 38.
Hmm.
And the reason I know that is because you can't make a French fry if with these sugary varieties unless they're over 45 degrees. Storage.
Hmm.
And so people unwittingly are going in there and they're getting these potatoes and they, you know, it's the food for the masses. It's their go-to food in places where people are impoverished.
And that's what's driving a lot of the issues around sugar and bad sugar and so forth.
Yeah. Oh boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wait.
That's a good place to end it with a kind of a cliffhanger note, but we'll definitely get together in the next couple of weeks and talk some more, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely. We got to get the word out. My whole deal is to help people.
Awesome. Jeff, I appreciate it. I will talk to you soon.
Thank you, James. Have a wonderful day.
You too.
Bye.